Buzz.com.
But I think, you know, just getting in a few bean bags and having some vending machines don't necessarily for a startup mindset make. I think the fundamental shift that a company has to make is to build two things. One is to encourage a culture of risk, saying, hey, failure is okay, we live with it. But obviously learning how to manage it and not offend your stakeholders, right? Which is a big challenge for a lot of companies. I think one is encouraging risk taking. I think that's, to my mind, bringing some of the startup culture in. Two, I think, is really rewarding success away from hierarchy. So I think in fundamental, if a company has to imbibe a bit of the startup culture, encourage risk taking, delayer the organizations, make it a true meritocracy. So if this 23-year-old has created a great idea, I mean, let him stand up there with the CEO in the next town hall and let him be applauded. And that will encourage a bunch of other 20-year-olds to say, hey, next, I want to be that.
Lloyd Mathias has served as a head of marketing for Hewlett-Packard's consumer business in Asia-Pacific. He's been the president and CMO with Tata Teleservices. He's also been the senior director and head of sales with Motorola, and a rich stint with Pepsi for over 11 years with a variety of assignments spanning brand, marketing, and category management. He was last with Pepsi as an executive vice president, marketing. Lloyd is now investing with startups. He's mentoring several of them, and he's consulting with leading organizations on the intersection of technology and consumers. Lloyd can be introduced as a senior corporate executive, a thought leader, an innovator with a phenomenal business acumen. He can also be described as what I would like to say, someone with a supremely childish curiosity, extremely energetic, and an insatiable thirst for knowledge, who reads infinitely much more than I do, and that's something which I really envy from him. On this note, I'd like to welcome Lloyd. And Lloyd, welcome to Pathbreakers.
Thank you, Upendra. I think that was a very warm and wonderful introduction, some of which I'm sure I don't merit.
So Lloyd, just to kick things off, from colas to mobile phones to printers to Internet of Things, right? You've navigated, steered successful businesses, products. You've set up new teams, set up new business lines. So I've got to really ask you, and this really sets you apart. You were at Xavier's, right? So as a student, were you one of the guys who was constantly having beef curry rice at the St. Xavier's canteen, or would one have found Lloyd more in the classroom?
Actually, strangely, neither. You know, my first port of call, and, you know, really St. Xavier's kind of grew the love for reading for me. I used to spend a lot of time in the library, right? So classrooms were kind of boring. Canteen was great, but it was like, you know, I would try and, you know, chalk it an hour or two, because there were lots of things that one had never had access to, which a large library like Xavier's gave you. The first time I ever read the Economic and Political Weekly was St. Xavier's. You know, I read back issues of Mad Magazine that, you know, forever. And all of these there were in the Xavier's library. So the library was a great learning place. And of course, the canteen. You know, classroom just happened. It's one of the things through 5 years of college, as you know. But Xavier's was a great learning place. And, you know, some friends for life and, you know, tremendous learnings.
So that's a common alma mater we share. And that's a different conversation. All right. So how would you describe Lloyd in college? A rebel?
I would say a bit of a rebel, but not in the classic sense. You know, I'm talking of the late 80s when people were actively rebelling on larger causes.
Sure.
That was not my case. You know, I kind of went with the flow. You know, everyone at that time was looking at engineering, medicine. I did a major in geology.
Okay.
And almost everyone in my class in geology went to the US and their masters and did other things outside of geology thereafter. I just found it a nice time in life when you could be yourself. You know, you broke out of the shackles of school, out of parental control. You met friends from the opposite sex as well. You enjoyed yourself. You learned new things in life. And in a sense, it was a great preparation for you know, all that I did the rest of my life. So I look back at those 5 years with great fondness.
And as a student and in your early formative years, what fascinated you and what inspired you?
One was, I think, the sheer diversity that one got to see in the real world, right? When you grow up, it's, you know, it's all a neighborhood and a bunch of friends who know your parents and such like. I think here was the diversity. Second is, I think, at that stage, it really pointed out to the fact that the world of opportunities is so large. You suddenly discover that, you know, there are so many more facets to life than, you know, just majoring or, you know, doing your engineering, medicine or getting a graduation. Just the possibility of the opportunities. And in a sense, for me, that opened up, you know, the rest of my life, because in a sense I graduated in the late 80s, and you know, by the time I hit the workforce it was the 90s, and that's when the Indian liberalization kicked off, right? And suddenly, you know, opportunities were more than, you know, taking a safe and state job with one company. Suddenly there was, you know, the global companies coming in, and you know, things really changed quite dramatically in the early 90s.
Okay. You have worked with multiple categories addressing the younger audiences, be it teenagers or young adults, right from beverages to telephony to mobiles, and of course your stint with Hewlett Packard. How do you see the younger generation having changed, and how do you see them even changing further in the years to come?
I think the change has been humongous. And, you know, like they say, all change is something you don't see in the short run, but you look back, you see how much people have evolved. I think one part of the change is really, you know, how India has changed in a manner of speaking, right? Our parents kind of came from relatively frugal backgrounds. You know, for them, kind of saving to ensure their kids got a better life than they did was the paramount part of their existence. They're also extremely loyal, right? My father worked for one company for 39 years. And that was their life. So they really kind of, you know, in a sense, for the first kind of post-independent generation, savings was critical. You know, building a house, providing for your family was the be-all. I think thanks to that upbringing, a lot of us, you know, had some of the, you know, comfort strokes, you know, things which we kind of took for granted, and were therefore able to try out new things, right? So in my career, I worked for, you know, four large companies. Today, I'm, you know, doing things slightly differently. And I remember when I changed my second job, I'd moved out of Pepsi and moved to Motorola, and my dad said, like, are you sure you're doing the right thing? And so I think the ability to experiment is much more. But when I look at a lot of the startups I work with today, and they're predominantly people in their late 20s and early 30s, I think I'm just fascinated by, A, their clarity of thought, B, the courage, the fact that they are willing to go out and experiment without having so-called built their nest egg, in a manner of speaking. And the best of all, I really think their ability to really, you know, kind of try new things without the fear of failure. You know, one aspect that never ceases to surprise me, you know, for us, the big priority in life when I first got working was, you know, buy yourself a house, pay off the EMIs, you know, buy a car, pay off the EMIs. And I'm truly, truly fascinated by young people today, right? They're very comfortable living on a rented accommodation. A lot of them even rent furniture. They stream music. They don't want to buy cars. They're happy, you know, using Uber and Ola. And I think that's refreshing. You know, it also comes from a sense of confidence that they're sure they're going to be earning and living a good life. But I think that is something that I've seen young people change dramatically. So ability to take risks, clarity of thought, and in a sense, a much better sense of balance, right? So holidays are important. Weekends are important. Having a good time is important. If I don't like a place, I don't like my boss, the money may be good, I'm willing to walk out of here. So I think that supreme confidence is something that I'm a big fan of.
And I must ask you this. We talk of Gen X. We talk of Gen Y. We talk about the sharing economy, the collaborative platforms. I agree with you on those. But if you were to step back, Has the younger generation truly changed in their emotional construct in terms of how important family is to them, how important are relationships to them? Has it really changed?
I think the core of who we are as Indians and the fabric of Indian society has not changed, right? So with all this outwardly change and, you know, the ability. But I think what is certainly changing is the need for young people to want to stay back at their parental home, right? There was a time in life, it was, you know, say 20 years ago, it's almost everyone you knew lived with their parents till such time as they got married and then had the need to move out. I see a lot of younger people now, you know, a year out of college, who somehow find the way to, you know, shack up with friends, but want to move out of that. So I think that's thanks. That reflects a sense of independence. That's one. But when it comes to a lot of traditions and cultures, festivals, I think that's kind of come back with a vengeance, right? You know, I live in Delhi now, and, you know, when I see the number of my friends' wives and a lot of female friends who actively celebrate festivals like Karwa Chauth, right? So these are hard-nosed working individuals, you know, comfortable living life on their own steam. But that one evening, they kind of, you know, put it all aside and say, okay, let's fast. And for a lot of them, it's the social aspect of it, right? They don't generally believe that, you know, fasting all day is going to, you know, ensure, you know, a great pot of gold. But the fact that they embrace a lot of tradition in a manner saying, hey, it's cultural, right? And it's the age of social media. Nothing like a great post on, you know, with the thali, with my husband's face reflecting on the thali and such like. So I think that part is it. So I think the fabric of tradition, our belief in old cultures and rooting stays, though with a slightly different interpretation. But at the same time, you know, people are moving forward and saying, hey, if I'm comfortable with live-in relationships, so be it. If I'm comfortable relocating jobs, new cities, moving, taking new experiences, so be it. So that's great.
So should we say that the plurality and the Indianness is still there at the core?
I think so. I think so. At the core. I think there is a tradition. There's a respect for older people. People still feel that part, which is not so apparent in other societies. You know, in my work, I've lived across, let's say, at least two different continents. And I find our intrinsic respect for older people is positive. It's something that I take as, you know, one of the things, markers of good Indianness. We do respect age tremendously, and I think that's good. And two is also our ability to take in diverse religions. You know, I seldom see any other society that is so comfortable across things, right? I can greet friends for Diwali and be part of it. I can, you know, have spent time with friends for Christmas. You know, I can go to a friend's house for biryani for during Eid. I think we're very seamless. And, you know, I pointed this out to some of my, you know, Western colleagues, Americans to be specific, in a couple of my roles. A lot of them kind of end of the year send you happy holidays. And I say, hey, wait a minute, you could have pretty much wished anybody Christmas, Merry Christmas. And they said, you think Hindus would be or Muslims would be offended if you wish them Happy Christmas? I said, not at all. In India, we celebrate at all, right? So December is a Christmas month. We celebrate. October and November is Diwali, and we greet everyone Diwali. I mean, you don't have to be. I celebrate Diwali. So I think, you know, that kind of diversity is what makes, you know, us so special.
Wonderful. Tell me something. Lloyd, 2 decades back, and Lloyd today, right? Or take any marketing professional per se. How would your approach to designing a product for the younger generation have been different from what it was then and what it is today? Is there anything fundamentally different?
I would say two things. I think one is young people are very conscious of themselves, their time and place, very self-assured. So primarily, I think, you know, taking into an extent an amount of personalization in design, right? So if it's a set of headphones, if it's a set of audio speakers, if it's whatever you're designing, I think the ability to tweak. Everyone believes he's different, right? The way I wear my headphones is different from how you wear your headphones. The way I like to listen to my music is different from how you do. We might still both be listening to the same genres of music, right? If metal's your thing, that's good. But here's how I like to listen with an overdose of audio. So I think one is keeping the personalization element. And personalization also in terms of look and feel, right? Anything that can have changing decals, that can reflect a bit of my personality. I think that's a big part. Which, in a sense, for me, is a reflection of the fact that there's so much of choice, right? There was a time in life if you got yourself a Sony Walkman, you arrived. But now you can actually, you know, want that degree of personalization. So that's something I would certainly keep in mind. The second, I think, is seamless connectivity. I think we are willingly living in a world that's, you know, connected 24/7. So how do whatever devices I have, how does it seamlessly connect to the internet and give me actually a truly contemporary real-world experience? Right. So I believe that, in a sense, you know, what is once called machine to machine and now called Internet of Things, I think is now just going to be a matter of fact way of life. Right. You're going to be with the net 24/7. You're going to have the net giving you a kind of screen of interpreting the world. And, you know, obviously one would keep that in mind when designing products for young people.
You've worked on a ton of new products and new categories. Any interesting experiences or stories of developing or rolling out products or services for the younger generation, and maybe something which worked out differently or didn't work out as much as you would have hoped for?
You know, I was lucky to be, you know, after a good stint at Pepsi, moving into Motorola. Mobile phones was still a nascent category. And there was one gorilla in the room. You know, Nokia owned 80% of the market. And one of the challenges in Motorola was how do you kind of tackle this behemoth, right, Nokia? And Motorola thankfully had this great set of products globally. The Moto Razr was launched globally in 2005. It also was a company that was willing to play with colors, with play with design, bring out the whole youth concept. So I think that was an amazing period because, you know, you could really suddenly, we were actually going and telling young India, you know, taking my Pepsi experience to young India and telling them that, do you really want to be have a phone that your father, your mother, your grandmother uses, right? Which is what Nokia did. Or do you really want to go with something that's totally new, trendy, cutting edge, global? And we just saw the switch. We saw people literally in their early 20s, first jobbers. That was the core market. And they kind of went en masse. And suddenly we moved from 1% market share to about 20 plus percent. So fantastic. Worked well. Great products, great design, color, new sensibilities, new approaches. Worked fabulously. But there have been cases when these have not worked as well. You know, in my last role at HP, we saw that transition. Because, you know, at one point in time, you know, printers were essential to a lot of upper-income Indian homes. Today, increasingly, people don't need to print stuff, right? You don't print your airline ticket. You don't print even your IRCTC ticket. So I think it's also environmental consciousness. People are suddenly getting conscious, do I really need to print? Do I need to really waste paper? And, you know, at HP, we saw this whole challenge, right? You know, kids 7 to 12 telling their parents that, hey, I could do without printing. I can take my reports to school, so-called electronically. So I think there are both sides to it, right? So that was a, you know, Moto was a great run. And in HP, it was really about how do you challenge, you know, current trends. The fact that people replace PCs or their laptops much less frequently because you can do it all on the on your smartphone. So I've seen that change, and I believe that you know, one has to be adaptable. You know, as a sales and marketing person, you just got to find new approaches to actually go back to the consumer.
And I'm glad you raised Motorola, and you also mentioned HP. And I've been very curious. You were in extremely interesting times in the stints that you were with Motorola and Tata Teleservices, one on the handset space and the other on the telephony connectivity space. Those are the times when things were evolving and rapidly changing, failing, creating, and everything was so rapid, be it on the product side, pricing, channel, customer segment, everything was moving. How do you as a leader or a marketeer manage to steer your way through a market where everything seems to be changing every couple of months?
A few key principles that I've kept in place. So I think one is, you know, it's across businesses, always, whether it's myself or the team, I think maximize the time you spent with your customers. And I mean, customers is not just the end consumer. It could be your trade, your distributors, your retail partners. I think a lot of information lies with what customers tell you about your product, about the insights. And therefore, I believe the only real way you can, you know, navigate change is understanding consumer insights, understanding what's in the consumer mind. So I'm a very, very deep believer in going out, spending time in the market, right? Every kind of additional moment spent in a conference room, in the offices, to my mind, a complete waste of time. The other principle I follow, Upendra, as a matter of routine and across all the teams I've worked with, is to try and get a diverse bunch of people together as part of your core team. And in a sense, this is a personal philosophy long before diversity became mainstream. Because if you look back at, you know, when I started my work career, almost everyone who kind of got into the management training pool had very similar backgrounds. You know, in a sense, relatively English-speaking households, you know, an engineering degree, a top-notch business school, very similar mindsets, very similar sensibilities. And soon discovered, and, you know, again, thanks to a great boss, my first boss at Pepsi, is that if you get people with very similar upbringing backgrounds, your thinking is going to be very staid and very standard. So the moment you get people with different backgrounds from different cultures, suddenly you're exposing yourself to so much more. So again, in the context of navigating change, I would say, you know, get people from very rich and different backgrounds because they bring in their own thoughts and cultures. And very often it isn't very comfortable. You know, in India, we're socially very conscious, right? We know people of a certain social class, but wherever you get an outsider, there's a disruption, everyone's, you know, eyebrows are raised. But I've actively encouraged that. So I do believe that, you know, it takes people across economic strata, across social classes, different states of the country, and that's always worked. So having different backgrounds, big principles, spending as much time as possible with the consumer. With categories, it's just a matter of once you go in and you understand the basic dynamics, it changes. But these two premises I always hold very dear to my heart.
I just want to touch upon the diversity angle. It's extremely tough, and I'm glad that you've been able to build diversity in your teams and your thoughts. But finally, you're the leader. When you have diverse teams, you also get very diverging viewpoints. But finally, it's for the leader to take and make that choice. So it's a two-dimensional question. One is when you have diversity in your teams, how do you as a leader finally follow up? Because finally it falls on you as a leader. The second is, are you also a classical believer in consumer insights and research? Or do you believe that sometimes you just need to take a call and that leap of faith? Maybe the consumers really don't know what they need. And I'll also tell you, I'm asking you these together, because when you look at these two dimensions together is when the leader has to take some really bold calls.
So great question. I'll answer the second part first. I do believe that at the end, a lot of great business decisions, you know, have a lot to do with gut. But I believe gut evolves over time, with the time you spend with the consumer, with your real experience in that category, understanding the market dynamics and understanding the implications of what decisions you take. So the real answer to me is spend as much time with the consumer, soak in the market, understand industry dynamics, but finally go with your gut, what you do believe, right? And invariably your gut develops out of all your experiences in that particular marketplace. On the first question, which is diversity versus taking a call, deep down, I'm a consensus person, right? So I do believe, you know, you can't run roughshod over, you know, your team's views. I also do believe that in a meeting situation, when you have six of your direct reports in a room and you want a point of view, they'll all try to kind of project what they think is your view as their view. So very often, and, you know, one of the kind of management tools or principles I've employed is I do a lot of one-on-one sessions with teammates, but individually, right? So if I have a six direct reports, then I calendar in a half hour cup of coffee with each of them separate days of the week, and then try and get their real feedback on lots of issues. So there are things, of course, you do together as a team in a common room and, you know, thrash out. But very often, you know, it's about one-on-ones. And in a sense, you know, my last role at HP doing the APAC marketing role, you know, nine of my team members weren't even based in Singapore where I was. So you actually, you know, had them on a conference call once a week. But very often you called up a guy and had a nice long chat on the phone, or, you know, every quarter when you visited a market, you spent time out with the guy, you know, over a beer and actually got a sense of what he's thinking. So I'd say that, you know, I won't ride roughshod over my team's point of view, but normally get them on board on a consensus and actually reflect their point of view. I'd love to say that very often I've gone with views which were not mine to start with, because a team member had an interesting thought and, you know, made more sense and was able to back it up with great logic.
Any interesting example which may come to your mind?
I would say, you know, I'd like to just go back and, you know, talk a little bit about my HP experience. I think, you know, in HP, we were always trying to look at that holy grail as a traditional marketer. Can I make this one kick-ass commercial that will work across, you know, 20 markets? And invariably found that there were different cultural nuances. You know, what's considered cool in Australia would just not work in China, and so on and so forth. And one of our team members came with this extremely good thought. He said that, look, this whole world is moving into this co-creation. You know, young people don't necessarily want to consume this sexy 30-second commercial made by a A-grade, you know, filmmaker. Why don't we just get, considering that, you know, our APAC region runs 20-odd markets, why don't we pick five or six markets culturally diverse, take a bunch of influencers, you know, ask them to spend a week at a place of their choice using HP laptops, and then ask them to generate content. So we got this, you know, pretty good idea. We worked with Disney Studios, but effectively we got an architect from India, a photographer called Audi. We got a fashion designer. We got a musician from Indonesia. So we got these six people from vastly different cultures, one Japanese, one Chinese, one Australian, you know, an Indian, an Indonesian, a Malay. We gave them 6 days in Japan to explore. They went together. They were given a certain budget and said, look, hey guys, go and do your thing. Do exactly what you love doing. Use the HP computer. You don't have to plug in, you know, our products and everything. And we got, I think, a sum of about 26 short pieces of content. They were fantastic. Straight from the heart, worked well. They developed their own hashtag. Each of them had sizable followings on, you know, Insta, you know, Twitter, various medium. So this was real content from the heart. This was stuff they put together. The whole thing we kind of slickly edited and kind of made a small kind of digital output for television or for any mainstream media. But it had so much more credibility. And it also drove home to us a point that while we had big celebrities in India, we worked with Deepika. Globally, we had a couple of big Hollywood stars. For a lot of young people, just seeing you know, someone in their immediate circle or seeing a well-known influencer, as it's now called, works as a much more positive reinforcement and a much more solid and stronger and a believable endorsement.
So, co-creation, crowdsourcing have become a little more common in marketing vocabulary today. But tell me, when you were heading that a few years back, you basically challenged the classical format of creating content, where usually a brand marketing person would brief a creative person, you go to an agency and you go to a producer. Now, the reason I'm asking this is, how do you navigate that change? Because there is a fundamental change in thought and approach of creating content to engage a consumer. Is there resistance? How does it work? Because everyone is used to doing things in a certain way.
I think there's a lot of resistance. And I think, honestly, a lot of businesses struggle with the challenge. You know, we all grown up in an environment where you wrote a brief, addressing a certain market issue. You shared the brief with the agency. The agency came out with some creative outputs. You refined that. Even before you made that particular ad, you researched the concept. And then you finally made the ad. And then you, presented it. And there still were hits and misses. The reality of today's market is, one, you don't have the luxury of time, right? So there's an environment where you made three big commercials a year. You know, one for Diwali, one for the summer campaign, one for mid-year. Today, in most categories, you're putting out two pieces of content a week, right, which is consumed. So one part is you don't have the luxury. The second, and I think which is even more critical in the context of, any kind of marketing program, is that the pace has changed far more dramatically. A lot of consumers want to be co-creators, right? They're not willing to just take a piece of content and, live with it. So I think letting consumers come into your domain and letting them do it is the other part. And that's where there's a lot of resistance. How can a bunch of six influencers do better stuff than, what BBDO has spent 50 years mastering the art of? It's always difficult. I think it requires a little bit of pushing, but I think it's real. It's a little encounter that I have, at my Tata Teleservices role. We suddenly discovered that when people complain about telephone connectivity or broadband failing, let's say they tweet saying, hey, my XYZ connection sucks. Now, if they do it on Friday evening at 7 o'clock, we had no one in the controls to respond to them till Monday morning. Now, in the world of social media, that's suicide, right? So we then discovered we need someone, manning our key social media handles 24/7, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And in one of our monthly ManCom meetings, I'll never forget, the MD of the company said, what if one of these, so who's the guy who does this stuff? I said, look, someone in the agency, and we know, they always have someone responsible. And he says, someone on his last day at work could say something very terrible about us. And I said, yeah, that's a risk we run. But that's the reality. I'd much rather have that occasional, hopefully with all filters gone, someone saying something totally off what your brand stands for, than having someone not respond to a consumer's for two full days. The MD promptly agreed. He said, this is the real world of social media. You need to have real people responding real time to real issues and run the risk of someone saying something that's off strategy, off brand, but that's life.
Now, a lot of these things that we do are basically to drive intimacy with the customer, be it delivering content, product, services, after service, right? Many teams and organizations today are looking at huge amounts of data and personalization as a path towards intimacy. My question basically is, are we missing the plot when we believe that data and personalization will lead to true intimacy? Or is there something that we are actually missing?
I think using data effectively is a great way to build stronger relationships with consumers. There's a fine line between using data effectively and invading a consumer's privacy. And I don't think any brand can always get it right because consumers are different, right? I find one reminder mail from, a loyalty program that I'm part of as just about right. I know friends would, want updates even more frequently. They'd like a weekly update. They find 1 month too infrequent. So people are different. Having said which, I think it's important for every brand, every company to have a contact policy saying, if I'm going to send people an update, if I'm going to send a email solicitation, if I'm going to send an emailer, advertising my product, I will do it with XYZ frequency at one level. two, I think the real challenge in data is how to cleverly integrate data and then use it effectively. Which means I have a data point of view as a consumer. I've got some interest in you. I know what are the areas you're interested in. Now, how do I use that data cleverly to give you the kind of content that will get you further interested in my product without offending you or without invading your privacy? I think that's a very fine line. And I think the knowledge of that is still evolving. Like, I believe, you know, we have two agencies right now. You have mainline agencies and you have digital agencies. And digital agencies have perfected the nuance of, you know, kind of digital marketing. But they haven't creatively evolved to the extent that the old creative agencies have. Whereas the traditional creative agencies still make fantastic pieces of communication that can move the brand needle, but they haven't evolved to the fact that there's a whole bunch of consumers who aren't waking up to appointment viewing, who aren't watching your favorite TV soaps, who aren't waking up and reading the Times of India. So I think that integration is what we're in the midst of right now. It's a challenge that I believe both digital marketing companies and mainstream creative agencies have to do. And I think smart clients have to kind of become a catalyst in this process. But that process is on right now, and it's a very fine line.
If I were to ask you, top of mind, which are those brands which come to your mind who are literally hitting the ball out of the park when it comes to relevantly connecting with their customers and truly being intimate?
Tough question. I can't think of any brands. I think some of the mainstream consumer goods brands are struggling with that. On the contrary, I believe some of, you know, the electronic brands, you know, Apple's a great example, I think is doing it fabulously well. One, of course, their product suite is so strong and, you know, they've got a bunch of cult followers. But I think, for example, just that outdoor campaign they run with, you know, consumers sending in photographs, which they choose to make billboards. It's a very smart, subtle way of saying that, you know, our phone's great. Without having to say so. So I think that always stands out to me as something classically iconic at a global brand. In India, I see a lot of the new age brands doing pretty good stuff. I'm, for one, a big fan of what Zomato is doing. You know, I just thought the way that they use that, you know, the recent issue of, you know, some consumers complaining, saying, hey, I've got a Muslim dairy bar, I don't want it. Suddenly to actually make a statement of purpose, saying, hey, Adoree Boys are Adoree Boys. Food is itself a religion. And we won't change our style of operations because someone doesn't have what I have. So I think it's important to be current, be contemporary, and yet be strongly grounded in values while building your communication. So there are a few brands. I think Zomato's done it well. Apple has always been a perennial favorite. But there are brands clearly struggling in this era. The traditional ones that, you know, had big budget producers making that classic 30 seconders. And you can see some of them slowly falling off that iconic status that they once had.
Is it because they're missing off on the conversational brand bandwagon, so to speak?
I think some of them have not tuned in to make digital mainstream. If you're always going to spend 80% of your time as a marketeer with your mainstream agency, and at the end of it, you know, have this great creative output and tell the digital agencies, hey, go and repurpose it. Like we once did with outdoor, right? You had a great print ad and then, you know, you said, you know, make 8 adaptations of this for my various billboards. I think that'll never work. I think every medium has to be thought of medium out and not, you know, creative out and then repurpose, right? And with, I think, to my mind, another area that is a big challenge is experiential. I mean, today people want to experience your brand in the real world. How do you give them that great experience? What is it that you can do to actually build your product into that experience? You know, as opposed to kind of slapping a banner, right? Even in digital, to my mind, you know, using banners are the worst possible thing you can do in digital. But if you can create a strong emotional story, I think people will buy it.
I then want to move on to another dimension, right? We're living in an era when you have super apps, deep features, new upgrades happening every 2 weeks, a software update happening every day, and so on and so forth. So at one end, you have a bunch of features and services which are constantly added to the core. And then you have another bunch of consumers who constantly seem to be saying, this is getting too much. I just need stuff delivered simple. So you're also having super successful products which are purely succeeding because they say, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do it well and I'll deliver it to you without asking questions. How do you balance making something extremely feature-rich And yet, all of us as humans know that we just want it simple, clean and intimate. How do you balance it?
Great challenge. I think, we're still in the process. I don't think anyone's cracked it. But you're absolutely right. I think what consumers want is someone who can respond to them almost in a human instinct, one-on-one, right? The simplicity with which I can tell Alexa, get me an Uber because I want to go to Andheri, right? That to my mind. Now, the complexity obviously happens at the back end. But you don't want to be involved with that aspect, right? You want to install your Alexa, you want to plug it seamlessly into your home, and you want to make a set of commands for which it responds and makes the whole transaction smooth. I think we're in the process of this slowly emerging. A lot of conveniences we take for granted. The Ubers and Olas have changed a lot of our travel styles. It has made things seamless. I think we're getting there. I think the adaptation process is always going to be complex. There are going to be areas that are difficult. But I think purely from a business angle, I would look at saying simplified, high-quality consumer output and very often make those choices for the consumers where possible, right? Guys who are not comfortable with it, won't live with your product, or would come back and possibly get it customized. But don't throw up a menu for everything, right? It's classically a case, I believe, is in our cell phones, right? Today, most of us have reached a stage where you've got a plethora of apps. Right, almost every store you go to will say, hey, download my app and you'll get a discount and there you go again. But most of us have got comfortable over time, possibly living our life out of 8 or 10 apps. We don't possibly need more. How do you kind of manage that challenge? Right, you've got a couple of social media apps, you've got a couple of shopping apps, you've got a couple of commute apps, Uber, Ola. Right, how many more are you going to get? So I think the idea is keeping it simple, giving the consumers what he wants and letting the complexity stay off his radar.
Now, the other operational challenge in the trenches for a lot of teams and organizations is the multiplicity of agencies and third parties one needs to deliver and work with. And most of them are struggling because things seem to fall between the cracks. The social media agency has a certain thought, the creative agency has another thought, the SEO agency has another thought, and they're unable to kind of bind it together. Any tips or what's worked for you in managing this ocean of agencies?
So I think it is a huge challenge. It's a great question. I have done typically one thing, which is you get all the agencies together in a room every time you do a new campaign or a new brief. You ensure maximum sharing of your entire objectives. But the one thing that never ceases to work is to have common objectives on which every agency's bonus is linked. Which means if you're going to get together and work together on this Diwali campaign, and I've got six different agencies in the room, I've got my PR agency, my digital agency, the one that does the SEO, I've got my creative agency. I think tell them that, look, these are our campaign objectives, right? Let's say the main creative agency is going to be anchoring the campaign, but this is the kind of business we want this campaign to result in. Should this work out, then 20% of so-called remuneration is tagged to that outcome of that campaign. So I think when everyone has his element of my fingers on the pie to get success, I think people tend to move more smoothly. But it's never easy. There still are issues. There's still a lot of problems. A lot of individuals from different organizations. And I think in that sense, that's been a step backward from the early 90s when there was the one consolidated agency, right? You threw a brief at J. Walter Thompson and they had the media department and they kind of worked the whole thing seamlessly. Now, very often as marketers, you're called upon to manage. Also compounded with the fact that today the quality of servicing people in agencies aren't what they used to be. Agencies have fallen off the salary pie in terms of getting new recruits. So I think it's a challenge. I think a lot of businesses are being recognized and work towards it. But my simple mantra is get them all together, share as much as you want. There's a bogey that a lot of businesses believe that my competitor will take my idea and run. I think that's overestimated. And not sharing information, to my mind, is a big, big problem. Clients not sharing enough information with their partners. Because effectively, if you want to be a great marketer, a great business, I think you've got to go out and share. There's nothing so confidential that can wreck your business as much as not sharing it with your partners.
Correct. We've spoken about teams, be it your immediate teams who are employed with you or teams with the agencies and so on, right? We always talk about experimenting. We talk about innovation. It's extremely romantic to talk about this stuff. But the reality is, it is extremely hard to experiment. And to create a culture and a support ecosystem which allows you to constantly experiment. Any tips? to make it happen?
I'd say two things. I'd say one, large companies have nearly lost their ability to innovate and experiment. I think the fear of failure is so large that everyone's so keen to protect your behind that no one's wanting to go out on a limb. And that's kind of de-risked the business. I think it's part of how businesses have evolved, but that's not very good. On the positive side, and I spend almost all my time with startups right now, I think what's really works for a lot of startups is the speed of decision making and the ability to risk and do things. And that comes from one single aspect. There's no fear of failure, right? Because today, a lot of startup entrepreneurs I know, they walk around quite freely with the fact that saying, hey, this is my third venture, my first two flopped. So I think the moment you take off the fear of failure, which, I mean, this one line to my mind is what really makes Silicon Valley so successful. It's that there are a whole bunch of people who've tried various things, failed, and a lot of funders and venture capital guys don't look at them with any degree of doubt, saying, hey, he's been through three failures. This time he's most likely to succeed. So they don't see it as a negative. So I think the whole culture of innovation today, sadly, is being incubated outside of large organizations. They're being perfected by the startups. Over time, they get acquired by the big companies who hopefully take that innovation and make it bigger. And I think that's a happy interface. But barring a handful of companies, I think Google and Amazon are great exceptions. A lot of the large corporations today have become pretty much, you know, great systems and processes engine. We'll take something good, we'll deliver it, we'll perfect delivery over time. And then, of course, with the vagaries of Wall Street, we'll cut jobs and cut costs and do all the rest of it. But pure innovation, I think, is very limited.
So imagine I am a head of marketing in a classical manufacturing concern. Let's say I'm making fans, okay? I'm sitting here with a bunch of ideas. And I've really got a very rich bunch of team members and agency partners who really have exciting ideas. And we really don't know whether it's going to work or not. I, of course, am operating in an environment which is still lying a few decades back, or let's say is more conservative. What can I do to start scratching the surface and try and moving the needle so that I can allow the larger organization to allow me to experiment as well?
The one thing that I would recommend, and I've used this in a consulting gig with a mid-sized company, is to convince the head of the organization or the biggest stakeholder, saying that have a 5 or a 10% margin of error built into your business. By this I mean is if your annual marketing budget is, let's say, X, let's take a number of 10 crores for what it's worth, right? So 9 crores is to keep the operating engine running, to generate your sales, to do your staff, to, you know, do the nuts and bolts. Have that margin of 1 crore, which is the experiment budget, where you tell your marketing head or you tell your agencies, hey guys, go out and try something crazy, right? And these are also open-ended briefs very often. And the kind of response you see, to my mind, always boggles in this particular case, where again, they had this money. So it's that little safety element built into the business. So my business still, you know, can meet all the headwinds, can function, can return its, you know, effective value to the stakeholders with that 9 crores that I'm using in my regular deployment. But having this fun fund or this, you know, the risk fund, when you tend to do something out of the ordinary. And very often, to my mind, it's the premise that, let's say, most angel investors use, right? You make 15 investments, you know that 10 of them will kind of go nowhere. Two or three might just struggle. Maybe one or two might get you a 10x, which kind of takes care of the other thing. So I think similarly with companies, learning to have a small bit of money kept aside for doing crazy stuff. And with crazy stuff comes, hopefully, crazy returns.
I'd like to share a story or an experience which I heard from another leader, and he was saying that they were discussing with their social media agency whether they were to start Quora and how could the brand participate in Quora. And he said, I got frustrated because I was sitting there for 3 months looking at pros, cons, standard operating procedures and so on. Then one day he just got up in the morning and he told his 5 team members, all of us are going to spend 30 minutes on Quora each day for the next 30 days. Lo and behold, within the first few days, they started getting the leads. And what happened is, the first is they changed their mindset that I need to work with an agency, there is stuff I can do. Second, once they started getting into it, they started understanding the pulse of it. Third, once the leads started coming in, the team automatically got energized. Because technically, he was honest enough, he was saying that was Vela time which the team had anyway. All right? So, what I was thinking is, Does it make sense that quite often when you think of experimentation, we actually want someone else to be doing it? Vis-a-vis sometimes it could be those small things that we could do and pick up ourselves.
Great example. I think I totally agree with you. I think very often great experimentation starts in-house. Until you dive deep into the media, that particular media head-on, you'll never figure out. And I've seen this with myself. And also you recognize that a lot of agencies are so scared to take the risk because very often their remuneration is linked to outcome. Right? So the agency you're working with is wondering that if I go to Quora and don't come up with suitably clever questions which has my client's approval, will I get paid or will I get shortchanged in the long run? So I think the good example, like you said, and I think increasingly brands have to embrace this, is trying out things yourself and really getting into every media, diving at the deep end, right? Who would imagine, say, a year back that TikTok would be so mainstream, right? Today, a lot of mainstream brands are getting there. But the moment you recognize that there's about 150 million people, Indians, who live their lives, so, go to TikTok and spend an hour every day, and very often they're not the same kind of Indians who are reading your mainstream newspapers and watching appointment television, I think you recognize it's too large a market. Now, the content may not be what you and me like too much, but if you can find people who can generate content for your brand, for that audience, it works very well. But that, again, means letting go. You're giving somebody else, letting go of your brand control, and you're letting some guy sitting in a small village in back of beyond Eastern UP to create content that is relevant to his neighborhood, not to yours. So I think that's a great example. And I believe, therefore, the more you open up, the more you experiment, the more you dive into deep media yourself as a client, the better are your chances of success.
We spoke about, or rather you mentioned, startups being in a situation where they're experimenting more. Then we are also seeing many large and medium, possibly even slightly older organizations who suddenly want to become like a startup. You will start seeing bean bags and beer bottles in the fridge and fancy lighting. And a lot of effort seems to be going in creating it. Now, what's your view? What should an organization fundamentally do to start thinking like a startup, for lack of any other word? Do the bean bags and beer bottles really help?
Not really. I think a lot of young consumers, though, in every company are, looking at slightly more fun workplaces as opposed to the old staid cubicle farms, as I'd call them. So I think that part is good. But I think, just getting in a few bean bags and having some vending machines don't necessarily, for a startup mindset, make. I think the fundamental shift that a company has to make is to build two things. One is to encourage a culture of risk, saying, hey, failure is okay. We'll live with it. But obviously learning how to manage it and not offend your share stakeholders, right? Which is a big challenge for a lot of companies. I think one is encouraging risk-taking. I think that's, to my mind, bringing some of the startup culture in. Two, I think, is really rewarding success away from hierarchy, right? In large companies, you'll have some great, fantastic idea that's coming from someone low down in the product management group or in the marketing group, but it's therefore the CMO or the marketing director who's standing up and taking all the applause. I think today the ability to call out successful people across the hierarchy is critical, right? So I think the delayering of the organization, recognizing merit, and then rewarding people who actually where the idea originated. And that's something large companies don't do very well. Because of that years of layering, good ideas get buried, they get de-risks along the journey and nothing really shows up with top management. So I think in fundamental, if a company has to imbibe a bit of the startup culture, encourage risk-taking, delayer the organizations, make it a true meritocracy. So if this 23-year-old has created a great idea, let him stand up there with the CEO in the next town hall and let him be applauded. And that'll encourage a bunch of other 20-year-olds to say, hey, next, I want to be that. So you've got to give them the same sense of saying that, hey. So I think it's about what I would call encouraging entrepreneurship, right? So within a large organization, build that entrepreneurship culture, create small teams. I think the rest of it, the beanbags and the coffee vending machines and the beer on tap will kind of flow from there. But it's really, you've got to give people an invigorating atmosphere where they believe their work is valued. And, how they feel is going to be a function of how it moves from there.
So taking forward, incentivizing risk, right? Great term. You have a CEO, you have a HR leader, sitting at the end of the appraisal year, you're looking at two people. There is one guy who's overshot his target by 30%. There is another guy who tried three things and they all failed, but the learnings were tremendous. Now tell me in this scenario, what are organizations doing to incentivize risk? How are they recognizing that achievement? Does it translate into a similar bonus for both of them? How do you cross that bridge?
If you ask me, the mainstream organizations are failing miserably. This is a great example. So the poor guy who tried new things and fell off target, possibly missed his bonus, the other guy got his bonus. And that is the problem. So I think the real change has to come when the company recognizes that, you know, the only way, if our objective is innovation and migrating into new markets, how do we incentivize the risk? How do we take away the risk, that fear of failure? And it's a challenge. And to my mind, you know, I look at a lot of mainstream organizations, they're kind of hurtling to the path of inconsequence because they're following the same method. And if you look at some of the spectacular failures, you know, the Kodaks of the world or the old Nokia as they once were, is that they missed the big trends. You know for a fact that Kodak actually was the company that invented the digital camera. But it was so alien to their main business of, you know, selling camera rolls and selling, you know, analog cameras, that this poor guy moved aside and eventually that industry, you know, finished the company. So I think it's normal for companies to miss the bus on this. But I think the change has to slowly become mainstream. And I think what's positive, purely in the India context, is that today a lot of young people are not overawed by brands. You know, my HP days, we went to some of, you know, India's top management schools. It was heartening to find that a Flipkart, you know, got a day one ahead of HP, right? Which some of us found startling. They recognize that young people today value startups. They value risk. A lot of them want to be entrepreneurs out of business school. They believe that they can make it good. I think that's encouraging. And even more encouraging is the fact that today the venture capital ecosystem has matured, where if you've got a reasonable idea, if you've got, you know, some proof of concept, your likelihood of getting funding is enormous. And you don't have to have a rich father to bail you out, right? So 30 years ago, you know, the amount of entrepreneurs that would come from mainland India were few. Today, I think it's opened up. And, you know, I think in a sense, the VC ecosystem has played a good role.
I heard Mr. Narayan, the managing director of Nestle, some time back, and he was posed this question in a larger forum. And the conversation was, he was sitting next to, let's say, a startup kind of an environment CEO, and he was sitting there and a few other intellectuals. And he basically said, if you are in a position to give a clear vision and purpose to the individual, could be the brand manager or the product manager, they will make it happen. It's not about the bells. It's not about the whistles. It's about giving them mission and a purpose behind which, and just give them an empowering framework. And then he said, everything else will follow.
I think it's a good point. I believe an empowering framework has to translate down the line. What does it mean to your performance appraisal? Right? If I get the 6 months to try out something new, and God forbid in 6 months that something new bombs, do I get a waiver on that 6 months on my employment appraisal? Or will the other guy who's, you know, got down to doing nuts and bolts of current business and we've grown his category by 10%, is he going to walk away with all the reward? So I think until that fear of failure or the risk reward is not adjusted to reflect this so-called empowering framework, it'll be a lot of talk. And, you know, my sense is large organizations have to internalize this deeply, saying that we have to get people to get rewarded for risk. That's how we're going to truly become innovators. Otherwise, we're going to be great delivery machines. And I would not take away from the fact that lots of our large corporations today are fantastic delivery machines. Their ability to go out, deliver a package to a consumer day in and day out, to get the distributor, to get the collections in, to collect the revenues, is great. And that is a skill set by itself. But parallelly, how do you incubate this entrepreneurship culture where you can get people in the company to try new things and therefore push the envelope and grow the market?
So you've done this a ton of times, right? New products, new categories, new businesses, new geographies. And you've triggered change and you've stimulated change. One of the biggest challenges in driving change is influencing stakeholders internal to the organization or to your teams. Any interesting tips in terms of how that journey can be simpler, easier, more efficient, or stories of what's worked for you?
As a general principle, I believe sharing the larger vision always helps. So the more people you bring in saying that, look, this is what as a team we are out to achieve. So sharing a vision very transparently, I think, is the first step. The second part is to take from the previous example in terms of Nestle, is how do you empower the guy who's actually making a difference? For me, that kind of rubber hit the road in a context that Pepsi had an inconsequential share in Bombay City, where we are right now. And then they took over an existing bottling, which was earlier owned by Voltas, who were the bottlers of Pepsi. And then the same bunch of 75 truckers who drove out with their product every morning who had kind of over time learned to understand that their place in the market was a poor 10%. How do you tell them that, look, now you're part of a global organization, now you can, you know, you can confront your competitor head on. If he breaks your bottles, you can break twice as many bottles. And really empower them and say that, look, we're on the way to be market leaders. I think, therefore, it was a kind of example where we got these 75 sales guys, took them for a two-day, you know, out round, which they'd never done before, and really told them that, look, now they're empowered. They can go and do exactly as much. They can match their competitor, not just for discounts. We can spend twice as much in terms of advertising. I think the moment the team felt that empowerment, we actually saw the change. The same guys who just about managed to hold a small conversation with a retailer in Bombay now were actually demanding their share of cooler space, who are actually doing a much better job. So I think it really is empowerment, but also telling them that, look, there's a large organization that's willing to stand by you. And once they get that feeling, you know, I think then people's motivations take over.
If I may, you're saying all the very nice things. There are those situations when you come across people who are extremely inordinately obstinate. And I'm not saying it's a fault of theirs,
absolutely,
but that is a reality.
Absolutely.
How do you climb those mountains?
I think that's the part where you use your judgment and you just move certain people out of the way. You fire them. I'm being very candid here. You're right. The people who just say that this is not the way it was done.
Sure.
Right? So the example I quoted in Pepsi when we took over this bottling system, there were a handful of salesmen who said, no, this is not the way we'd work. We don't like this new culture. This is a bunch of young guys trying to tell us how to do things. I've sold soft drinks for 20 years. And, you know, after a couple of sessions, you realize these guys are going to be a negative influence. You just move a small bunch of them out. I mean, you know, that's life, right? So the people will actually buy into your vision. Some of them will actually come in over a period of time kicking and screaming, and the some who never will. And the ones who never will, you could recognize them early and let them go.
And I'm glad that you raised it. So should it be fair to say that for a leader, when they're getting into a transformational stage or a change which they're inculcating, should they clearly have this in the back of their mind that they might really need to take harsh calls?
I think one of the big hallmarks of a leader is the ability to take hard calls, to take harsh calls, and to not get too emotionally upset by it. That's part of it, right? One part is you're delivering against a larger objective. Yes. In the process of that, you might take some hard calls. What might seem like something humanly very unfair. Sure. But I think at that time is when you hold your reserve and you make that judgment. And I think it's important. So I think hard calls are essential to great.
I've launched over 25 products, including jelly drinks and jelly crystals and so on. And for different reasons, many of them really didn't do fabulously well. And I know I've gone through those phases where I've pretty much not shown my face in very visible places in the office, right? And when I look back at it, I often wonder, would it have been great if someone came and just patted me on the back, saying it's okay. It did impact my bonus increments and so on, but I still went going for it. Any tips, not very macro stuff, any small things which managers and leaders can do in their day-to-day actions to make it a bit easier when things don't work out for their teams?
I would say very important, like I said, is to, you know, to tell a person that a failure is not a reflection on his abilities. It's a fact that a certain set of situations didn't work well. Maybe the product was too premature. Maybe the product wasn't good enough. Maybe the product wasn't researched well enough. So I think all these are very valid. But to always separate failure from the individuals. People can fail, but it's not always them that have failed. It's very often a set of circumstances. I think to draw that exception is very critical. Two is also to kind of take away the learnings from that what went wrong. I think what we don't do very well is, you know, really chronicle our failures to know what resulted in that failure so we don't repeat them. And to my mind, that is a very, very big part. I'm sure everyone who's, you know, today so-called a success has had a share of failures. We've all had them. I had some, you know, pretty big disasters. The quick thing to do is one is to cut your losses soon enough where you know it's not going anywhere. And the second, you know, as a manager or as a leader is to tell people that, yes, failure is fine, so long as it doesn't let us impact and we take those learnings and don't repeat it in the future. So I think it takes a little bit of, I would say a little enlightenment. A lot of organizations don't handle failure very well. I think appraisal systems are notorious for, you know, badly de-rewarding or badly penalizing failure. But I think it's something that needs working on. And like I said, Silicon Valley is the gold standard in terms of, kind of taking off fear of failure.
Okay. Now, influencing and changing behaviors gets extremely important when you're bringing in new products and categories. Any interesting examples that you can share from your experience where you needed to really move the needle on changing a behavior?
I think often it is about, you know, a product that's very well entrenched, right? And let me tell you a classic example. You know, at HP, we had this issue of fact that today people's PC lifecycle replacement has reduced, right? Most people at one time change their laptop every 2 or 3 years. To the extent to which you use a smartphone in lieu of your laptop, very often people don't change their laptops for 5 years and more, right? So that's the time. Now, one of our issues was, how do you change behavior on this category? I think very often you end up working with categories outside your own. So a very large e-commerce company, they announced that they were going all app only, which would be one more nail on the coffin of the laptop. We went to them. We had a discussion. We told them that, look, a lot of high net worth people still do their purchases on larger formats like desktops and laptops, and kind of persuaded them to stay back within the web ecosystem besides having an app. And that helped. That, in a sense, we believe it kind of, you know, reduced the decline of PC replacements to an extent. So very often you need to work at ecosystems outside of your own, you know, to kind of extend the lifestyle of your category. But sometimes you're walking in that path and there's little you can do. But the extent that you can change the ecosystem, you've got to work towards it.
Okay, so this is a question I've been yearning to ask from the moment we started this conversation. You've had the privilege of managing very large budgets, very large teams, and very large organizations. Huge canvas. And now you have your sleeves literally rolled up, working with startups, where obviously the teams, the budgets, and everything are not really that large. How do you as a leader move from an environment having gazillions of stuff, whereas you can actually count on your fingers the actual amount of resources that you have? How do you as a leader make that transition?
I think the fact that I consciously chose to work with the startup ecosystem, I think I actively made that choice. And the reason I did was for three reasons. I think one, it's, you know, my learnings have been immense. And the reasons for that is fundamentally young minds. Like I said, these are people who are coming from an ecosystem vastly different from the one I was used to. Let me tell you, I mean, I did some work with a furniture rental company. Now, in my mind, furniture rentals was always something that would be done by 20-year-old geeks who, you know, who can't afford to buy furniture. And as I went deeper into that business and met a few customers, I realized that people in their 30s and 40s in cities like Mumbai and Bangalore are happy to rent furniture when they change homes. And they change homes frequently because they change jobs frequently. Right? If I'm moving in, you know, Bangalore from Electronic City to Koramangala, I'm going to change my house and I'm not going to be saddled with legacy furniture. So these are responsible, respectable, high net worth 35, 40, 50 year olds who are actually changing jobs. So I realized, A, that, you know, this whole furniture rental thing is not a fly by night. I even know of a case of this customer who actually rented a branded painter, one of India's well-known artists, because she was having an overseas visitor on the weekend and she wanted to impress him with her choice of Indian art. So I think one is recognizing the fact that new business models, different ways of operating, I think is one huge learning in this process. The second part, I think, is that it strips you off of notions of what separates you from the organization. You recognize that a lot of the so-called glory that you worked in the past was because of this big brand name and this lovely business card you had of a large organization. Now, very often, you're working with your own intellect and your own expertise. So it's a great reality check. You know, it kind of, you know, you come to terms with yourself. You come to realize that people are eventually going to respect you for the intellect and the value that you bring to the table, not for this mega billion-dollar global Fortune 500 company that they earlier saw you as part of, right? So it's, in that sense, I love the fact that I am who I am because of who, what I represent out there, not because of the large organization that I do. The third part, which is, you know, my big buzz for this place is the kind of flexibility. You know, it's hugely refreshing, Upendra, to wake up in the morning and plan your day to your advantage. I don't have my kind of calendar open to my team and to the global organization. I don't have 4 conference calls. I don't have 3 pre-scheduled meetings. I don't have a, you know, long weekend of appraisals to be done and reports to be generated and sales calls. I pretty much plan my month around what works for me. So yes, I have a set of companies I work with. Yes, I give them a certain amount of days and hours a month. But it's all worked around my timetable, right? I realize that this month I need to be in Bangalore for a weekend because there's an important family occasion. So I do set up all my Bangalore meetings in the latter half of the month. You know, I'd spend 4 days working and then 2 days holidaying and, you know, partying with family. So I think the ability to, A, chart your own course, do your own thing, the ability to realize your true net worth as opposed to the large organization, and the ability to work with new business models, younger people, usually invigorating. So I'd look at the last 18 months has been possibly my biggest kind of new learning curve. Then a lot of my previous, I learned great things in large organizations I worked for. But I think the need or the ability to challenge yourself every day is best in this ecosystem. So I'm delighted to be part of this ecosystem. My learning curve has grown marginally. And after a long time, I wake up fairly energized every morning.
So in the last 18 months, and I do know that you work with a lot of startups, have multiple conversations. Is there one specific question or situation which really confounded you, where you actually said, damn, I've been working for all these decades and I have no clue how the hell to go about this?
Oh, quite a few times. So I would say I encounter this possibly, you know, almost once a week at an average. So a lot of, I think the refreshing part of working with startups is that they look at everything de novo, right? So they challenge a lot of established conventions, right? So one of the companies I was working with, they're trying to build their distribution ecosystem. And I give them a set of parameters saying that in every town, there's a handful of guys who work with the top 10 consumer companies. These are guys who have good respectability. They're, you know, got great equity. Every banker in that small town knows them. Let's take the town of Ratlam, right? There are 8 or 10 distributors who between all the majors have the businesses. They're respected. The local bank manager knows them. The local MP knows them. The MLA knows them. And I said, that's the person you want to work with. And, you know, came the startup founder and said, but that's exactly the person we don't want to work with because we are number 10 in his rank, right? He doesn't make his bread and butter, right? He's happy with the Unilevers and the Nestle's and the Procter & Gamble's and the LG's and the Samsung's. And when we thought about it, they were perfectly right, saying that if we're a new business and we are fighting to make impact in this large world of big sharks, shouldn't we go to this new guy? And of course, initially we had the issue because the new guy was not recognized very well by the banker. He didn't have great credit worthiness. You're going to entrust a product, you know, worth X every month. But then we found that the energy, the passion, because this guy was building his whole life around your product category. And what he gave to you was immensely more. And I think these moments, you know, I come across all the time where I work, you know, with a certain set of assumptions that unconsciously sometimes. And, you know, there's a 20-something who can look at you in the eye and says, look, you're talking crap. And it's refreshing. And it challenges a lot of your values and ideas. And like I said, that's what I'm in this game for.
Okay, so Lloyd, we're going to head into the quick fire section, or you can call it the rapid fire section. Mm-hmm. But the best aspect of a rapid fire is, even if you do extremely well, you don't get a coffee hamper. All right, so this is going to be random
stuff. I'm going to pretend there's KJO sitting in front of me nevertheless.
Poor KJO. All right, so this is going to be random stuff. It's about yourself, it's about business, about your thoughts, and some possibly just intrigue to get your view on it. Mm-hmm. All right? So, we'll start it off easy. Mountains or beaches?
Mountains.
The best book which you've ever read?
The Story of My Experiments with Truth, Gandhi's Autobiography.
Gandhi, yeah. One of my favorites as well. Favorite movie?
Godfather.
First crush?
An English teacher in school.
Not bad. That's another conversation, or maybe another podcast. All right. Tongue in cheek, blue or red?
Blue.
I'm going to be red, so for old time's sake.
My old Pepsi loyalties.
And I used to fight on the rooftops at the Goldsworth factory, but that's another conversation. All right. Describe in 3 words the worst boss you've ever had. I mean, feel free to add more words.
I think 0 empowerment, no trust.
Okay. All right. Long term or short term?
Long term.
Culture or process?
Culture.
Your winning mantra?
Take a deep breath and do what your gut tells you.
Okay. Play safe or go for broke?
Go for broke.
Really?
Absolutely.
Not bad. I need to hang out with you much more often. Okay. All right. The most exciting innovation of recent times. What comes top of mind?
The iPod.
Okay. The one thing which you wish you had invented?
A parachute.
All right. The one thing you wish you could disrupt?
I think urban transport. I just think lots of our cities just need complete big disruption.
Okay. The one thing that really bugs you?
I think long commute hours. You know, Bombay is a bad place to discuss this, but I think bad commute really pisses me off.
Okay. the one thing which still gives you goosebumps, even today?
Every time I listen to the Indian National Anthem, moves me like hell.
Wow. All right. In your mind, the main ingredient for success?
Passion.
Passion?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Now, you've done a bunch of stuff, and knowing you, you will do much more in the coming few years. If I were to ask, what would your professional epitaph look like?
I'd wish I'd been an entrepreneur earlier in life. Right now, I'm in the entrepreneurial space. But I think the time to be an entrepreneur is sometime in your 30s, when you haven't got kind of well set in your career. So I'd like to be looked back at someone who, you know, has challenged existing norms, has made a difference, and has worked with people in a manner that's made them successful.
Three mistakes that you made in your professional career, which come to your mind?
Like I said, one, not turning entrepreneurial earlier. I mean, I wish I'd kind of made that break. That's clearly one. Two is, I think, getting on to an international assignment much earlier. I did a couple of them slightly later on. I think getting on earlier because the world is globalized. And, you know, in India in the 90s, we didn't realize it so much. The third, I would say, is not doing cross-functional stuff. I wish I'd done an HR role sometime in life. I never have. But, you know, cross-functional experimentation, something I haven't done enough.
All right. And if you had $1 billion to invest right now, where would you put it?
EVs, electrical vehicles. I believe that's the future.
You're big time into...
Oh, absolutely. I believe, you know, today where we stand in urban commuting and in travel, in terms of vehicles, is the smartphone revolution that happened, let's say a decade ago. So I think, traditional internal combustion cars are, the next 10 years are going to be a big question mark on their future. EVs are the future.
Okay, so here's a call out to all investors who have $1 billion. Please contact Lloyd. He has a few EV things on his hand. All right, Lloyd, I'm extremely happy to inform you that you haven't won the coffee hamper. But it's been an incredible pleasure, enriching as always. And once again, thank you so much for being...
Absolute pleasure, Upendra. Lovely. And I'm going to insist on signing this coffee mug, though.
See you, Lloyd.
Thank you. Thank you. Awaaz.com